Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store, and this is On Point. Georgia voters are headed back to the polls in just a few weeks, the start of an election year that, on the whole, doesn't look optimistic for Democrats. Midterm elections are always a challenge for the party in the White House, but in Georgia, Democrats believe the long-term future is bright. A once solid red state, Joe Biden won it in 2020. Dems also now hold both of the state's Senate seats. But will Georgia shift toward Democrats last, or is its purple status a product of the unique moment brought on by Donald Trump? Greg Bluestein is a political reporter at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution and author of a new book, Flipped: How Georgia Turned Purple and Broke the Republican Monopoly. Before we talk about what's going on in the current election, Greg, can you take us back to election night 2020? Were the Republicans optimistic about Donald Trump going in?
Oh, yeah. And by the way, thank you so much for having me. I'm so happy to be here. They were optimistic. They weren't caught off guard by the Democratic, you know, energy and momentum, but they were very optimistic going into election. And I was sitting there in the front row of David Perdue's election watch party in the fancy Atlanta neighborhood of Buckhead. And there was just this sense of optimism, of energy, of excitement. I was watching young aides to Republicans check their phones frequently, you know, whoop and holler at the election returns as they were coming in. And then I looked at some more veteran strategists who were also in the room who were having the exact opposite reaction because they were looking a little bit deeper into the numbers and knowing that, hey, you know, just because these early returns look good in majority Republican counties, that the numbers overall look dimmer because so many Democratic strongholds in Georgia and really elsewhere around the country were still outstanding. And that once those votes came in, the picture would change dramatically.
So take us a little deeper into that night. You're there. David Perdue was facing off against John Ossoff in that Senate race. John Ossoff had run elections in the past and lost. So is that sort of explain that disconnect a little more between the aides that probably were thinking that this is Georgia, we're going against some a known name against someone who has already tried and lost, but what the strategists were really seeing?
Yeah, well, first, I mean, David Perdue is a former Fortune 500 chief executive. So one of the things he likes to do is always analyze the competition. And he has been watching Democrats very closely over the last 6 years and knew that they were registering more voters. They were finding new ways to connect with disconnected voters, voters who skipped midterm and presidential elections. And he was watching the competition very nervously and warning that, hey, you know, even though he felt like he was a much better candidate than John Ossoff was on paper and on the campaign trail, that Democrats could surge. But there was a lot of people in the Republican Party who didn't heed that warning in a sense. And at that campaign party, I saw interns and donors and just people celebrating, you know, popping the bubbly, ready to declare victory for David Perdue because those early numbers showed him with a big advantage over John Ossoff. But again, those early numbers were coming in from mostly Republican territory, and you had hundreds of thousands, more than a million by midnight, more than a million votes still waiting to be tallied in mostly Democratic-leaning areas. And it was going to take a while because so many of these votes were coming in through absentee ballots in it. And it took days to tally all those absentee ballots up. And because they came from more populous areas that tended to lean to the left, Democrats knew that in the long haul, they had this advantage. But at that moment, you know, you just saw this sort of unbridled optimism clash with the jarring sense of reality that was to come. Wow. And me and a few other aides and that a few other people in that room kind of knew what was going to happen. We're watching it from the sidelines.
So let's back up big picture now from what you've learned in covering Georgia politics and in writing this book. Is your basic thesis that 2020 represented a sort of fluke that was caused by a number of factors, including Donald Trump? Or was there something much bigger going on in both the Democratic and Republican parties?
Yeah, great question. This was not a miracle. This was not some overnight success from Democrats. This didn't just happen by happenstance. This took years of on-the-ground work from people like Stacey Abrams, who's a national figure, but also from folks like we just heard from Adrian, from other operatives and activists and volunteers and voters on the grassroots level who spent the past decade building up the Democratic Party of Georgia into one that could harness this demographic change of newer voters, of younger voters, of voters of color who, again, who didn't vote in elections, who felt disconnected from the process, who felt alienated, to give them a reason to vote. And at the same time, it had to harness, it had to take advantage of what was happening on the other side of the ticket, which was the Republican infighting over Donald Trump and the mixed messages of the former president saying, go vote in a rigged election, which, of course, we know is a lie. It was not a rigged election. But boy, did it confuse a lot of Republican voters.
So in writing this book, you, as a reporter who covers the day-to-day of politics there in the state, as you were writing this book, were there revelations that surprised you or that you didn't know as you were going through and telling the whole story in this way?
Yeah, you know, as a reporter, you get this front row seat. You're covering these major events as they're happening. But going back and interviewing hundreds of people, going over events that even that I might have been literally on the front row for, but didn't have the context or the ability to take a step back, and now I did. So I learned so much and tried to relate so much in the book about the people and the personalities and the motivations driving all these political figures that are now household names, not just in Georgia, but around the nation, the Stacey Abrams, David Perdue, Brian Kemp, Brad Raffensperger, Raphael Warnock, all these characters, I tried to bring to life as people to describe why they were doing what they were doing at the moments they were doing it, and really how, in some sense, how Republicans, especially during that runoff phase, were in this relentless battle to appease Donald Trump, and nothing they did was enough. Nothing they could do ended up satisfying Trump's demands.
So we're going to get more into Donald Trump's impact on the election a little bit later. You started off talking about being at this watch party at David Perdue's headquarters on election night. Did you see the same sort of dynamics playing out with the other Senate race, the one between Kelly Loeffler and Raphael Warnock?
Yes. You saw the same dynamics going off because they were paired together. I mean, they made the strategic decision early on, just as the Democrats did, to run in as a team. You know, Democrats needed to do that. They needed to win both seats in order to flip control of the chamber. Republicans didn't necessarily need to do that, but they knew that their fates were intertwined either way. And so you saw Raphael Warnock outpoll John Ossoff. He got more votes than John Ossoff did. But for the most part, they were this kind of, they had this bromance. I have a chapter in the book about the bromance that the two Democrats formed. They were always friendly with each other. They always got along. But during that runoff phase, they had to kind of almost be tied at the hip, especially for John Ossoff, who needed to energize African American voters who were the cornerstone of the Democratic coalition in Georgia. And as a young white Jewish man, he knew that he needed to find new ways to get black voters to come out in droves for him.
So why was 2020 so different from 2016? I mean, we're gonna dive into all the ways the Democratic Party changed and later on what the Republicans did. But your takeaway from what happened in those 4 years in particular, why was that so dramatic?
Yeah, well, the first major takeaway is Donald Trump. In 2016, it was not shocking that Donald Trump won Georgia. He was always expected to win Georgia. But what was shocking was the margin of his victory. It was 5 points. You know, this is a state where Republicans would win statewide candidates races by 10 points, by 8 points. But to have it go down to 5 points and to see Donald Trump lose the North Atlanta suburbs Hillary Clinton won Cobb County in Georgia's northwest suburb, Atlanta's northwest suburb, and Gwinnett County, Georgia's northeast suburb, for the first time since Jimmy Carter's era. So this was a major transformation, and signaled also that the North Atlanta suburbs, which stereotypically, like many other suburbs, are seen as this lily white, homogenous sort of area, is not anymore. It's very diverse. Yeah. Gwinnett County is among the most diverse suburbs in the nation, and they have become real foundational blocks for the Democratic Party. So that was one of the major shifts.
Well, I want to hold you right there. Mm-hmm. I want to play a little bit about Donald Trump. He thought he was going to win that. But by the end, both candidates were rallying in Georgia a lot. They had sort of taken it for granted. So here is Donald Trump in Macon, Georgia, on October 16th, 2020.
I love Georgia. I love being with you. This is Georgia. This is Macon, Georgia. We won Macon, Georgia. We're going to win it again. It's great to be back in the heart of this incredible state with the thousands of loyal, hardworking, unbelievable American patriots. Thank you very much.
So that was in October. I mean, why did it take Donald Trump so long to realize what you saw the strategists realizing on election night?
Yeah, I mean, so Donald Trump's strategy and Republican strategy was to kind of circumvent the Atlanta suburbs and spend more time in exurbs and rural areas. And in even though Macon is a mid-sized city that's predominantly Democratic, he was in the airport kind of on the outskirts of Macon, where in a giant area where he drew thousands of supporters. There's probably easily more than 10,000 people there at that rally. And he would come again to North Georgia, basically on the eve of the November election. So it shows you that they were trying to wring out as many Republican votes they could in sparser rural areas while Democrats were focusing on bigger, more populous areas like the suburbs of Atlanta.
All right. Well, Greg Bluestein is a political reporter at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Please stay with us. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. Today, we're talking about the inside story of how Georgia turned purple with Greg Bluestein. He's a political reporter at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution and author of the new book, Flipped, How Georgia Turned Purple and Broke the Republican Monopoly on Power. Greg, most of your book is about the way Democrats were energized by Trump's victory in 2016. Stand by for a moment so we can hear from Adrian White. She is the vice chair of the Georgia Democratic Party.
Historically, you know, I make a joke and say Republicans wake up every Tuesday and ask themselves, is it time to vote today? I just hadn't seen that energy on our side. But after 2016, I think Democrats were just like, hey, let's get involved in every election. Let's knock on doors. Let's do whatever we can to push back at this evil thing that had come to fruition with the election of Trump.
While there was an energetic base, there were many Georgians who just weren't engaged with politics.
They are trying to feed their families, feed themselves, go to work, all that good stuff. So they're just not receiving a message, period. So going to their door, getting in their email, getting in their phone via text or, you know, wherever, again, meeting them where they are with simple messages of we are for jobs, we are for healthcare, we are for fully funding public education. Like, I don't think any of the messages that even Stacey or any of the down ballot candidates really brought forth were extreme in nature or far left. They were simply clear.
The Stacey she is referring to is Democrat Stacey Abrams, who ran for governor in 2018 and lost, but focused her efforts in 2020 on combating voter suppression. White says she's, quote, cautiously optimistic about Georgia Dems' chances in this year's governor's race, but she's worried about the impact of new voting restrictions signed into law by Republican Governor Brian Kemp.
Democrats really learned the laws that the Republicans put in place and won their game. Like, we took their rules and played their game and beat them. Yet now they've kind of moved the target. We just want to make sure that people understand that the way you could do things in 2020, sometimes very easy, very conveniently, may or may not be the way that you can vote this time around. So that tends to be what gives me the most heartburn, is just this re-education and re-informing people about how they can vote.
So, Greg, we'll talk a little bit more about the upcoming election in just a bit. But first, I want to ask about the energy among Democrats after 2016. What is that like compared to what Adrian was talking about here in 2020?
Yeah, and Adrian is kind of one of the unsung heroes of the Democratic flip of Georgia. In 2017, I was there, or I might have been really late 2016, but right after Donald Trump's victory in Georgia and elsewhere, she and other Democrats held a party basically called the What Happened Party, and it was in town Atlanta, at a really cool trendy bar. You know, usually their events might have attracted a handful of the regular crowd, you know, maybe a dozen or so hardcore Democratic activists. And this one attracted hundreds. And there was a line out the door. And that was sort of, in a sense, a wake-up call for me of, okay, this is really energizing folks who didn't usually tune in on a daily basis to state politics. And that was when there was really the start of a movement in Georgia. Back then it was called the resistance movement. Of course, it's morphed over the years, but a movement to go and try to recruit more candidates to run, more activism, more on the ground engagement in 2016 that the hope was would carry over into 2020. And, you know, our first big signal of that was in 2018, when you saw Democrats flip a number of state legislative seats in the Atlanta suburbs. You know, Democrats continue their gains in especially North Metro Atlanta, very dense populated areas. Stacey Abrams' near miss against Governor Brian Kemp, losing by about 50,000 votes and in the closest gubernatorial election in decades in Georgia. And the biggest victory for Democrats in 2018, and sort of a proof point that, yes, they could continue to build on their gains, was Lucy McBath, a congresswoman, a congressional candidate, winning in the North Atlanta suburbs by a decent margin over Republican Karen Handel. So going into 2020, Democrats had this proof point. They had something to build upon, not just another wave of losses, but in some near misses, but some victories too, that they could say, hey, they could tell donors, they could tell activists, they could tell supporters that, hey, there is a pathway forward if we keep going in that direction.
So this wave that they had, as you said, they had to build upon that moving forward. And they were faced with a couple of paths to take, and they didn't all disagree on which of these two paths to take. Talk a little bit more about that.
Yeah, especially in 2018, the two paths they could take were symbolized by Stacey Abrams and her Democratic primary opponent, Stacey Evans. Stacey Evans was also progressive and had supported a lot of liberal ideas. But her main argument was, we've got to reach out to former Republican voters, to Republican voters who might otherwise vote Democratic, but have voted Republican for years. Stacey Abrams said, hey, we can get those voters as well, but we can get them by energizing the base. Our first and foremost principle must be energizing the base, activating and reaching out to and mobilizing voters, primarily many of whom were of color, many of whom were younger and didn't have a tradition of voting in midterm elections. We had a number of Democrats who would basically run as Republican light over the years, who ran on NRA-friendly platform, who steered clear of national figures like Barack Obama, when he came to town. And it wasn't seen as this controversial move. It was seen as conventional wisdom. And Stacey Abrams and her allies kind of upended that conventional wisdom by embracing issues like gun control, criminal justice reforms, like voting rights pushes, things that you just didn't hear statewide Democratic candidates embrace in previous elections.
And did she get pushback from that from within the party?
She did. There was a number of Democrats who felt like there was no pathway that way, you know? And again, it was the conventional wisdom to avoid Barack Obama when he came into town. When two statewide candidates in 2014, avoided Barack Obama like the plague when he came to town in October, right before an election, people barely batted an eye. I mean, we wrote about it, but it was not seen as a shocking move. And of course, in hindsight, now it does, because Barack Obama came a few days before Stacey Abrams' vote and the election in November of 2018 and had a huge rally for her. And again, came in 2020 to back John Ossoff and Raphael Warnock. And it was seen as a no-brainer, right? Of course he's coming. But that just showed to me how quickly politics have changed. And the issue of guns is also another example. You know, as I mentioned, Democrats used to parade around as NRA Democrats and voted for gun expansions. And then in 2018, you had Stacey Abrams boasting of her F rating with the NRA. Just in 4 years, there was this shocking transformation over guns that is now, again, conventional wisdom in Georgia politics. Of course, Democrats support gun control, gun restrictions, but you know, it wasn't always that way.
And in 2020, Abrams made herself known. She made her presence felt in that election, too. The Democrats were pouring everything they had into the runoff election. And it was obviously a huge moment for John Ossoff and Raphael Warnock and for President-elect Biden. And Stacey Abrams, who wasn't running for anything at all, was really at the heart of it.
Well, we got to do it again, guys.
Yes, ma'am.
A few weeks ago, we had a conversation about what was at stake in these elections. We talked about the fact that we were in the midst of a global pandemic. Well, we've gotten a little closer to salvation with a vaccine, but the vaccine isn't going to solve every problem. And we have an economy that's in peril, but a new president can't solve that alone. And we are in a space where racial reckoning is not going to disappear just when the years change. We've got to stay committed, and we've got to have a plan. Well, I've got two plans, John Ossoff and Raphael Warnock.
So you have a black woman leading a campaign to get a black preacher in Dr. King's church and a Jewish son of immigrants elected to the U.S. Senate, and they won. So what does that say about the change that Georgia has undergone?
What a transformation. I think you summed it up perfectly. And it shows that Georgia has undergone this metamorphosis. We're not quite sure yet how long lasting that metamorphosis is. You know, if Georgia will flip back this coming November and what will happen. But clearly we have had this transformation in Georgia where Democrats have established this path to victory. It's a tenuous path. It was built on all sorts of things that might never happen again. The Democrats certainly can't count on, starting with Donald Trump being on the ballot or a surge of absentee balloting voting during the pandemic. But also it was built on messaging and candidates who consistently were authentic and showed that they could stay on their message and not be sort of knocked off their heels on whatever was happening in Washington.
So let's look at the Ossoff race. How did John Ossoff, the candidate, change between 2017 and 2020? And how much of it was him changing and how much of it was the state changing?
Yeah, you talk about a metamorphosis, right? John Ossoff ran in the special election for the North Atlanta House District in 2017. It was the biggest election. It was a special election. It was the biggest election in the nation at the time and ended up, you know, costing about $60 million. So it set all sorts of spending records at the time for congressional races. And when he got in the race to attract attention, he called himself the Make Trump Furious candidate. But as he started consolidating Democratic support and becoming a more national figure. He ran a more conventional campaign for a suburban district that had been held by Republicans for decades. He didn't mention Donald Trump's name. He steered clear of national Democratic figures like Nancy Pelosi and others. And he talked not as much about progressive policies, but more about, you know, making the Atlanta suburbs the Silicon Valley of the South, and, you know, just issues, broad-based issues like that. Well, after his narrow defeat in that special election, he invited me to go up with him to the North Georgia Mountains, a very Republican area where, if basically in these parts of Georgia, if you're a Democrat, you have to fight to be a Democrat. You are pretty liberal. And at that meeting, he kind of unveiled a new platform where he talked about eliminating college debt and more public spending and just embracing core liberal ideas. And of course, the crowd loved it. You know, they basically said, where was this John Ossoff during the congressional campaign? And when he launched his 2020 race, he said, hey, he learned. One of the things he learned from the 2017 race is to be himself. And I know it sounds very simple, but authenticity matters, and voters can kind of see through if you're not being your true self. And we saw that more true self of John Ossoff throughout the 2020 campaign, where he was talking about issues that, again, that Democrats didn't talk about 10 years ago, but were embracing in more recent years. More public spending, more infrastructure spending, criminal justice overhauls, prison reforms, more transparency, stricter ethics rules, all these issues that had kind of gone on the back burner for Democrats and Republicans, he was putting out front and center. And it helped him do what he needed to do, which was not just energize liberals, but particularly energize African-American voters, who, again, formed the backbone of the Democratic Party in Georgia. And without them, he could never have come close to defeating David Perdue.
So, Greg, you're telling the story of all of these Democrats who are embracing these ideals. Ossoff talking about public spending and infrastructure and criminal justice. You talk about Stacey Abrams really energizing the base, and Lucy McBath winning on a gun control platform, which, you know, she has a very personal story with the shooting death of her son. Just things that you didn't expect Democrats to talk about in a place like Georgia, and it worked. So why do you think that Democrats more broadly, and even the Biden campaign, why didn't they invest in Georgia as much as they did in other states like North Carolina and Florida, which they ended up losing and which didn't seem to be having the same effort to energize Democrats in the way that Georgia did?
You know, that's a great question, because Georgia always, I mean, Nkema Williams, who's a congresswoman and also the head of the Georgia Democratic Party, always said that Georgia was the battleground state, was the premier battleground state. It just took a long time for national Democrats and donors and national media and others to realize that fact. And, you know, as you mentioned, Georgia was seen as a sort of tier B battleground state. It was in the top class, but it wasn't as high up as, let's say, some of those upper Midwest states that were so much of a focus of the presidential campaigns, and maybe even Florida and North Carolina, other states the Democrats were aiming to flip. And what Stacey Abrams always said was, hey, Georgia's a cheap date. You know, demographics are moving in Democrats' direction. New voters were primarily either from liberal-leaning parts of the country, or were younger, or were people of color. So the demographics were working in Democrats' favor. But also, you know, Georgia has one major media market, Metro Atlanta, which is relatively less expensive than other major media markets. And so it's easier to sort of play ball here in Georgia if you're a national campaign. And also you had the Democratic infrastructure that Stacey Abrams and her allies had built. So you had this ready-made operation. And what they were always saying was, if a presidential campaign was to invest in Georgia, they didn't want it to be a fleeting investment. They wanted that investment to help build a sustainable operation, one that could be durable and reused right now in 2022 and in future elections. And so that was always her pitch, was, hey, don't just spend money at the last minute here. Don't just, you know, spend money on TV ads that are, you know, very visceral. They disappear, right? They don't matter in the long run. Spend money on some of that, but also spend money on the infrastructure. And that's what sort of the path that Democrats had paved for the national party and the national donors here in Georgia.
Do you think this is something that other states can reproduce, other Democratic parties in states?
It can be, but boy, will it be tough, right? I mean, and there are other states that have the demographics leaning towards Democrats like they do in Georgia. There's other states like Texas where there's a tremendous number of younger and voters and voters of color who tend to vote Democratic. But you also have to have the bench. And Georgia didn't have a very deep Democratic bench not so long ago. But now, you know, you've got just at the top of the ticket, Stacey Abrams, Raphael Warnock, John Ossoff, all household names in the political world, at least, and then a number of up and coming candidates. So it will not be easy, but it can be done.
Greg Bluestein is a political reporter from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Please stay with us. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. Today, we're talking to Greg Bluestein, political reporter from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution and author of the new book, Flipped, How Georgia Turned Purple and Broke the Republican Monopoly on Power. We've talked a lot so far about how the Democrats won in 2020 in Georgia, but we also need to talk about how the Republicans lost. There's one anecdote in the book that's really striking, and it's from Jeff Duncan, the Republican lieutenant governor of Georgia. Duncan is a conservative Republican who supported President Donald Trump's reelection. Duncan was asked to introduce Trump at a rally on the eve of Election Day, but he says he was getting increasingly nervous about the way Trump was talking about election results before the election happened.
I'm one of those guys that just feels like it's more important what you do than what you say. So I picked my words carefully, but I spoke to a crowd of, you know, 30 plus thousand folks wearing Make America Great hats on a really, really cold night before the election. And I said a couple of things that shocked me as to the reaction of the crowd.
What he said may not have been controversial with Republican voters in the pre-Trump era.
I said, every time we lower taxes, it's not just for Republicans, it's for Democrats, too. And there was a slight scattering of boos. And I said, every time we improve education in Georgia, it's not just for Republicans, it's for Democrats, too. And the boos got a little bit louder. And I landed with this notion of our ideas are so good as Republicans, they even help the people that don't vote for us. And the boos became, you know, to a much higher level. And I walked off the stage and looked at my wife and kids and said, something's wrong.
To Duncan, it wasn't just that these people were booing some of our nation's core democratic principles. It was also a potential electoral disaster.
We know what we had to do to win the election as Republicans. We had to convince not the right to vote for us. Certainly, they're with us. They're carrying the flag. We had to convince the middle that we were responsible enough to vote for. And that's where the misfire happened.
Duncan wasn't surprised on election night when Donald Trump lost Georgia, but he says his attention was immediately on the runoff elections for Georgia's two Senate seats. With control of the Senate in the balance, the seats were must-wins for Republicans.
Unfortunately, I spent 9 weeks begging Republicans to not pay attention to Donald Trump's rhetoric around the election being rigged and all the other, you know, shiny objects that were out there to divert the attention away from his his unfortunate missed layup here in Georgia. And unfortunately, it didn't work. And now we have a democratically controlled Senate.
So, Greg, how much of the result in 2020 was due to the Republicans losing it, and in this case, the missed layup of Donald Trump, and how much of it was due to the Democrats' dogged years-long effort to run smarter campaigns?
You know, I think it took both. You know, there was a political operative who said basically Democrats had to pitch a perfect game, but they also had to rely on Republican missteps. And as Lieutenant Governor Duncan said, there were a lot of Republican missteps, starting with Donald Trump and starting with the fact that he was encouraging people, or maybe not so much encouraging people in some cases, to go vote in a rigged election. In his words, of course, again, it was not a rigged election. But that mixed messaging, I could see it everywhere around Georgia. I have an anecdote in this book about how Senator Kelly Loeffler's campaign aides were out there canvassing and knocking on doors, but they had an entire list of Republican voters who were diehard Republicans, voted for Donald Trump, voted in every Republican election reliably. But they were in this database in Kelly Loeffler's campaign inner sanctum under the heading GOP not voting, because they were kind of seen as lost causes, believers of these election fraud conspiracy theories, and that no matter how much attention was paid to them, no matter what efforts were delivered to try to change their minds, they weren't going to vote because they thought the election system was flawed. And these were, again, very deeply conservative Republican voters. I mean, I saw Mike Pence, the vice president, get booed when he encouraged Republican voters to vote by mail because of all the lies about absentee voting that came back to haunt Republicans. So you saw it everywhere on the campaign trail. It's impossible to see exactly the impact it would have because runoff votes tend to be lower turnout in general. So it wasn't shocking that it was slightly lower turnout. But the very fact that tens of thousands of reliable Trump voters, people who voted for Trump, didn't show back up and vote for Kelly Loeffler or David Perdue, led some Republicans, including Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger, to say that Trump authored his own defeat in Georgia.
So was this something that was coming up closer to the election, or was there a longer range change within the Republican Party in the state in the same way that you saw the long-term change in the way Democrats ran campaigns?
You know, to me, the change really accelerated in 2018 when instead of seeing Brian Kemp after he won the Republican nomination, when instead of seeing him try to move to the middle and try to pursue broader base policies, he stayed on the party's right flank. And his strategy throughout 2018 was basically conceding the fact that the Atlanta suburbs were going to flip and that he wasn't going to make much headway there. Still spent millions of dollars on TV ads in Metro Atlanta, but his campaign was primarily focused far outside Metro Atlanta on rural counties where Donald Trump won 80% of the vote, right? These very, very conservative rural counties in Georgia, sometimes with only a few thousand people. Well, Brian Kemp went from, you know, Donald Trump won 80% of some of these counties. Brian Kemp won 90%. So the strategy was to wring out as much conservative voters, as many conservative voters as they possibly could. And that continued in 2020 with Republicans not trying to message to the middle either. They're trying to just energize that core base of voters they had.
Yeah, and that's a very different very different than the sort of the two roads that you saw the Democrats considering whether to take, whether to swing more to the left and stay moderate. It seemed the Republicans chose to stay to the right. And Georgia Republicans made pretty clear that choice to go further and further to the right. You write about this famous or infamous ad from now Governor Brian Kemp in 2018.
I'm Brian Kemp. This is Jake. Young man interested in one of my daughters.
Yes, sir.
Jake asked why I was running for governor. I said, one,
cap government spending.
Two,
take a chainsaw to regulations.
Three,
make Georgia number one for small business.
And two things if you're gonna date one of my daughters.
Respect.
And?
A healthy appreciation for the Second Amendment, sir.
We're gonna get along just fine.
Brian Kemp for governor. And at the end, he points a shotgun at poor Jake. So why do you think it is that not just Governor Kemp, but Kelly Loeffler and Perdue and all the Republicans decided that going to the right was the right call?
Yeah, and poor Jake, indeed, you should see the look on his face. It's just pure terror. I don't know how many takes it took, but as much as that ad outraged liberals and middle-of-the-road voters and got all sorts of national attention, it might be the single biggest factor of why Governor Brian Kemp made it into a Republican runoff against the then-favorite Casey Cagle and ended up getting Donald Trump's endorsement. And it's for that reason that, you know, that's the question you asked, but playing to the party's base. You know, just as Democrats are trying to connect with voters who felt alienated and disconnected with, Republicans are trying to emulate Donald Trump's strategy, which was going after the so-called forgotten man, going after building a red wall in Georgia, finding voters that also skipped elections, you know, also felt disconnected, felt like there was no politician truly speaking to them. And you know, with an ad as polarizing as this one and with messages like rounding up, another ad of Governor Kemp's was, I'll round up criminal illegals in my own pickup truck, right? That was another ad that got a lot of attention. And he felt by kind of going to the core culture wars arguments, it would polarize and galvanize voters to come out to the polls in droves for him. And also by villainizing Stacey Abrams, by treating her as a sort of like arch nemesis of all things that are Georgian. And, you know, they painted her, even though she's spent most of her life in Georgia, they painted her as this outsider who only wanted to use governor's office as a stepping stone and to the White House or to federal office. And, you know, those tactics can work to galvanize and to mobilize conservative voters, and Brian Kemp used them to great avail in 2018, and surely we'll see, and we are seeing Republicans use it all over again in 2022.
So it's one thing to sort of double down on the issues that lean to the right. It's something different to try to make voting harder, and certainly to try to overturn an election after the fact. We all know that call that Donald Trump made to Georgia mm-hmm. officials. And on the one hand, you had Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger saying that there was no fraud in the election. But on the other hand, he and the other state Republicans were pretty united in efforts to limit access to the vote. Talk about that aspect of the Republican Party.
Yeah, as Brian Kemp was the Secretary of State, he pushed strict adherence to voting laws, which meant purging a record number of voters from Georgia's rolls who were deemed ineligible or who hadn't cast ballots in recent elections. It meant pursuing what they call exact match standards, which are standards where your name has to exactly match the name on your photo ID, which meant if there was even a letter transposed or a hyphen misplaced or whatever, you would have problems voting. And it meant other changes, other restrictions, other obstacles to the ballot box that would make it harder for people to vote. And we've only seen that kind of accelerate after the 2020 election in Georgia, certainly being the focal point of a battle over voting rights. And you had Brian Kemp going against Stacey Abrams, who of course champions herself as a voting rights advocate, as someone who wants to expand the electorate, who fought in court against something they called signature matching, which was if your signature deviated a little bit from the official signature on an absentee ballot, your vote could be held sort of impending, right? There's all these different rules that all told could have affected thousands or even tens of thousands of votes. And in a close election, like we had in 2020, when just 11,000 or so votes divided Joe Biden and Donald Trump, then yeah, even the slightest change could really matter to the ultimate outcome.
How much does the division within the Republican Party over whether or not there was fraud in the election and whether to carry that false claim of fraud, that torch from Donald Trump, going to play out? I mean, talk about how is that still playing out? Talk about David Perdue's challenge of Kemp.
Yeah, Kimberly, it's still playing out in such a major way. I mean, even as, you know, just before we started speaking, David Perdue, who's challenging Governor Kemp in the Republican primary, unleashed an ad, launched a TV ad blaming Kemp for the Democratic victories and saying that he, you know, basically promoting these lies about election fraud. And it's put the Republicans on the other side of Trump's wrath, on the wrong side of Trump's wrath, in this very awkward position, because they can't say a bad word about him if they're running for election. So you're not hearing Governor Kemp attack Donald Trump by name or attack his policies. You'll just hear him focus on David Perdue and on his own agenda. And, you know, it's this very bizarre scenario that I think that makes Georgia the biggest test of Donald Trump's influence in the entire nation, because he's endorsed 8 candidates here, but many of them are not sure things. You know, in other states, he's endorsed a lot of incumbents, a lot of Republicans facing only token challenges. In Georgia, he's endorsed a number of candidates with real uphill battles that will test the extent and the depth and the power of his clout in I think the nation's most politically important battleground.
And the winner of that primary, of course, will face Stacey Abrams. Do you think Stacey Abrams can win?
Yes. You know, it's very hard to predict what the electorate will look like in October and what the prevailing issues will be. Right now, of course, it's inflation, it's fuel prices, it's the conflict overseas, it's the economy. You know, in October, it could be a whole different suite of issues. Democrats acknowledge they're facing this uphill battle, but they've also got unity on their side where Republicans are fighting. And even if Brian Kemp wins a runaway victory and is the Republican nomination, the Donald Trump specter isn't going away. Donald Trump's not going to just forget that he's made Brian Kemp one of his top targets over the last few years. You know, that will continue, and it will continue to pervade in the minds of many Republican voters who are still on the fence about Brian Kemp. Just if you look at Stacey Abrams, she's already an icon to many liberals. So she doesn't feel like she has to go and appeal to the party's left flank as much. So right now, her message is pretty much twofold. It's expanding Medicaid, which is broadly popular among, in polls at least, among the broader Georgia electorate. And it's fighting gun expansions. She is opposed to a measure that Governor Kemp just signed into law that she calls criminal carry, that rolls back licensing requirements for people who carry concealed handguns. And so that's another issue that, you know, we'd never see a Democrat support, statewide Democrat support in 2014, but has become front and center to her campaign right now in 2022.
With Stacey Abrams at the top of this ticket, what impact do you think that will have carrying forward what we've been talking about, this Democratic momentum? Will it push it still further, or is there still any skepticism about Abrams based on the fact that she ran before and lost?
I think she's locked down. I think she's consolidating Democratic support. She didn't even draw a primary challenge. There's no open talk among Democrats about her strategy. You know, every so often I'll get a text or someone critical of her in general from Democrats, because, you know, sometimes Democrats are their own worst enemies. But overall, you know, she's seen as sort of the queen maker of the Democratic Party in Georgia. She recruited Raphael Warnock to run. She was a supporter of John Ossoff all along. So she is solidified the Democratic base. The question is, can she expand it into enough to win in November?
Greg Bluestein is a political reporter for the Atlantic Journal-Constitution. Your book, Flipped, How Georgia Turned Purple and Broke the Republican Monopoly on Power, is out tomorrow. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.